Hi everyone. A brief note before we get started with this last episode of season one. This was recorded in the summer before Bobbi Leach assumed her current position as chair of Viatech board. Special thanks to all of the staff that helped make this possible. Thanks especially to Ian Rasconi, who edited most of the final episodes, as well as this one, which had some audio cleanup that needed to be done. Thanks again to Ian Rasconi for his audio editing and post-production skills. Thanks again to Quadratic Sound for all of your on-site recording setup and services, as well as your post-production in the early part of the season. And Manjinder Benning of Limbic Media for his music jingle, and Rosemary Media for the brand icon she created. Please do stay tuned for season two coming up in the spring. Thanks again for everyone for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Bye for now. Welcome to Coded in Canada, where we talk with technology leaders in Victoria, BC. I'm your host, Sean Crabtree. Today we'll be talking with Bobbi Leach, CEO of Revenue Wire for 9 years and Viatech board member for 5. She won the Stevie Award for Female Executive of the Year, as well as the Viatech Executive of the Year, the first woman to do so, both in 2015. Let's talk with Bobbi now.
Well, tell us about Revenue Wire for folks who don't know it.
Yeah, so Revenue Wire started 11 years ago. So it was really the brainchild of successful entrepreneurs here in town, Elton Pereira, Adrian Pereira, and their brother-in-law, Don Wharton. So it started, you know, as a family-run business, but they'd also launched another business called Pareto Logic, a little bit older and a little bit ahead of what Revenue Wire was. And so they were managing that full time. And so they made a decision pretty early on to hire an independent management team to come in and grow the Revenue Wire business. Mm. And essentially that's where I come in. Mm-hmm. But so they were the original founders. And, you know, 11 years ago to create a payment solution for software companies that they literally could onboard and be live with taking payments globally within the same day,
right,
was pretty innovative.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't say we were the market leaders, because there was a couple other companies in this sort of vertical,
right,
but we certainly were one of the early day companies, and that's, you know, how we were able to accelerate our growth, and there wasn't a lot of options 10 years ago,
right. And so, I think we had these issues as well in a startup that I was in 2003, which is having to get like a merchant ID and all this. This is what you essentially.
So we do all that for them.
Right.
So it's the same as
you were what we were looking for.
Yes.
Seven years before you launched.
Yeah, and that was the challenge, right?
Right.
That was the challenge of if you went directly to a gateway like a Chase PaymentTac or a Wells Fargo,
right?
Not to get your own merchant ID,
right,
you usually ended up in 6 months of banking hell.
That's
because you have to go through all the paperwork and applications and, you know,
getting flashbacks,
compliance. And yeah, it is. It's a
like
very
PTSD.
It's
from that
very
time period.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's terrible.
It's a very cumbersome, slow, painful process, especially
right,
if you are a younger business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you don't have the expertise maybe yet. You don't have the resources, and you're just, in our case, the partnership we have with our clients is our clients can stay focused on their service and their software, their SaaS company, and they can essentially outsource all the complexity of payments,
mm-hmm,
in a global arena to us.
Right.
And we worry about, you know, onboarding different gateways and different payment options and making sure everything is PCI compliant,
right,
and making sure that we have the functionality to not just charge, you know, initial transactions, but recurring transactions,
mm-hmm,
which
sure,
is another level of complexity again.
Mm-hmm. Subscriptions.
Subscriptions, yeah. Right. Which yeah. a lot of businesses nowadays are following that subscription model.
Uh-huh. And do you plug in for apps as well, like the iTunes Store and things along those lines?
Certain apps. So mm-hmm. A lot of our clients need automatic integrations with CRMs.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're integrated with Salesforce as an example.
Right.
We're a fairly API-centric business to begin with, so a lot of times they're taking our various APIs and plugging that into whatever tools that they're using. But for those clients that, there's sort of two categories of clients, some that are very, want to have the control and use the APIs and be able to customize things for their business and their flows.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the clients that, no, we don't really have that expertise or time or effort. We just want the account and we want it to be configured so that we can just, you know, scale up our business.
Right.
And so that's really ready to go as opposed to being custom through our APIs.
For sure.
But we have both types of clients.
And would you say your business is a bit 80-20 with sort of 80% of the people wanting sort of automatic and then the 20% who are more API focused? Do you find it's something along those lines? Can you apply that Pareto principle in that regard?
You can, but it's from two different perspectives. So if you looked at it from our volume of transactions, you know, then of course the 20% of merchants represent the 80% of revenue.
Right.
But if you just look at the number of clients, you know, it's a small number of clients that have that size. Yeah, yeah.
Going to the 80.
You got it.
The inverse.
The inverse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. So you find that. Find that clearly is.
Yes.
That's fascinating.
Yes, absolutely. The math is true.
Wow. Pareto is, he's doing great these days.
Yeah.
He's living off those dividends.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Well, if you don't mind, I think I'd like to rewind a little bit and let's find out about the young Bobby, if you will. So I was so curious about a decision that you made very early in your career where I read right after business school, you chose to go to a small sports marketing company.
Yeah.
And I was hoping you could take us back to maybe your time in school and what led up to there. And then what was that arc that led you in down one road versus another?
So I would say, maybe at least in my generation, the majority of high school students didn't necessarily know what they wanted to do in their career.
Mm-hmm.
And by grade 10, I knew I wanted to do business. I loved creating new things and I loved sales and marketing. My parents always thought I was so weird because I'm like, I'll go door to door for that. Yeah, give me the chocolates. Okay, I'll go sell those. They're like, okay, you're weird.
That does sound weird.
It does. But I was always, so even though I was very business oriented and very much like tackling new things, I was also into sports. And at some point in my grade 12 year, my mom actually learned about this very unique program at the time in Canada. It was the only program in Canada. It was at Laurentian University. And it gave you an honors degree in commerce. So you got the business discipline. And the major, you didn't get to pick your major because the major was sport marketing. And so you took courses on sport and law and sport management and sport marketing. And I was so excited to go into that type of program where, you know, my passion of sports and my, you know, interest and gravitation towards business stuff was blended together.
Amazing.
And then
they made it for you.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just, and most of the grads from that program went into pure sport organizations, like mm-hmm. the NGOs of sport and mm-hmm. Or government organizations that manage mm-hmm. sport complexes and sport entities.
Mm-hmm. As well as professional sports, would you say?
Yeah, yep. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. CFL, some of the grads mm-hmm. went into CFL or went and worked for an NHL team. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. absolutely, that was sort of the career path. In our fourth year, we had a gentleman come and speak to our fourth year group He ran a sport marketing agency, Henry Storgard. And I was just like so enthralled by what he was doing and his excitement and passion for representing celebrities and sport events and going out and fundraising and bringing these to fruition with their clients that I basically picked up the phone and phoned him as my usual style.
Right.
Like, hi, I want to work for you. And he had just started that company that year.
Oh, wow.
And one of the people that he represented was Alex Bowman, who was a double Olympic gold medalist in swimming. So he won big at the 84 Olympics down in LA.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. I'm dating myself now. Wow. I probably shouldn't have done that. But yes, that's the era. And
I think everyone wants to hear from the elders in the tech community, whether they're young elders or elders.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There's lots of learning. That's for sure. I can't deny that part.
That's how you get the experience.
Yeah, that's how you get the experience. So yeah. I just wanted to be able to make a difference and have more control over my career and have more influence and making an impact on things. And you can do that in a small business. So. Uh-huh. I essentially was employee number three, and within 3 years I became partner and Henry and I grew that business into a multi-million dollar company that about 3 years in, we pivoted out of sport. It used to be called SportCom, and we pivoted out of sport marketing and went into, more, traditional marketing consultancy. And just start growing the business that way.
I think I read somewhere that you said you love things that aren't entirely figured out yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. So this brings you to like your late 20, like 27,
yeah,
26.
Yeah.
That's astonishing. I mean, what a rocket ship from leaving high school, going through, I'm sure, this white hot passion time of learning, going lockstep right into a startup that's like a rocket ship. It must have been an astonishing time for you.
I learned so much more than all the people I went to university with.
Right.
And I don't mean to undervalue what they learned in their careers.
Right.
But in those early days, when you're first graduating from university,
mm-hmm.
If you take a role that's with a big corporation, you're going to be in a very narrowly defined role.
That's the experience I had, in fact.
Yeah. So your progression and what you learn and what you get exposed to
mm-hmm.
is tempered by that box, right?
Completely.
But if you go and start your career with a startup, with a smaller company, and it can be tech or it can be any type of business, you literally are going to get exposed to everything and have to become, you know, good at multiple things because that's how a small business survives and grows. And so I just, early on, it's evened out over the years, but early on in my career, I felt like I had so much more, such faster progression in terms of what I learned and what I was able to then take on in terms of managing the business.
Right. Wow. So then where did you go from there?
So that was in Ottawa because I went to university back east,
uh-huh.
grew up in Victoria.
Oh.
So I'm from here.
Oh, okay.
And went to university in Ontario, lived in Ottawa for about 10 years.
Okay.
And then got an opportunity to move back to Victoria, which is when I started my tech career.
Uh-huh.
So I've been in tech for about 20 years, so the late 90s.
Yeah, yeah. Good time to get into tech.
Yeah, it was pre-dot-com bubble burst. So it was really the Wild West, right? It was the new frontier, and everybody was learning what this new internet thing was and how to do businesses online. And I consider myself very lucky in my opportunities. And in this case, it was a brand new business again. It was called Education International. It was started by the past dean of the business school at UVic, Dr. David Bogue. And he started this business, which was helping universities and colleges recruit students online. And so again, I, you know, joined the business shortly after it was started,
wow.
helped to grow that business into, again, a multi-million dollar business, and was a shareholder in that business as well. And that was super exciting because we had, you know, and this is, again, dating myself, but we had a dynamic website.
Right.
Those things didn't exist back
right.
then, right?
Right?
Everybody threw up PDFs and, you know,
right.
JPEGs and everything was yeah. by page and ASP.
HTML.
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah. all of those.
Look at the different size of those fonts and the different colors.
Yeah, yeah, but you couldn't search anything.
Right.
But because we represented, close to 2,000 institutions that were advertising through our websites for their various undergraduate and graduate programs,
mm-hmm.
and they were recruiting students globally. So from, you know, as locally as their state to nationwide to international students coming from China.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be searchable and it had to be organized in such a way that we could really target the different audiences and help that user flow into essentially applying
right.
to a university and college. Because
mm-hmm.
that's the service we were providing
for sure.
was this ability to capture new student inquiries and applications and ultimately help that institution.
A sales funnel.
Yeah, totally. That's exactly what it was. It was an online sales funnel for universities and colleges.
Wow. So again, you stumbled into serendipity.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course I learned a ton because again, you know, we went from probably again around that 10 or 11 mark in terms
mm-hmm.
of number of employees.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
at some point we got to just shy of 100.
Mm-hmm.
We went from having a single website to over 50 websites. We went from having sort of a single product focused on international students to having probably 15 to 16 different types of products targeting undergrad biz versus graduate business, undergrad in engineering versus ESL. Or so we had quite a range of markets that we were marketing
for sure.
universities and colleges. And then we launched a brand new business in
mm-hmm.
that
yeah.
growth business, which was Student Counselor. I don't think I've mentioned that.
No,
in
that's right.
other
I haven't seen that.
Discussions, but
that's
yeah,
right.
so
it surprised me.
Yeah, no, Student Counselor was brand new launch business that targeted high school students and high school counselors and allowed that high school student, high school counselor to enter in all the high school students' courses and grades and match that against our database of universities and come back with a probability of whether you'd get accepted or not.
Wow, this must have been so cutting edge at the
oh,
time.
Oh, there was nothing like it.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
the only thing on the market that did it.
Wow. And now what year is this, would you say?
So this is 2001. Probably 2001.
Yeah.
yeah 2001,
uh-huh.
2002.
Wow.
In that time frame. And so while the rest of the education international business had clients around the world, we had clients in Australia, UK, the majority of our clients were US based.
Mm-hmm.
Student Counselor was Canadian focused. We were
mm-hmm.
recruiting, and it was a subscription model, which was also very leading edge. There wasn't the subscription businesses that we have nowadays.
Right.
And so high schools would subscribe to an annual fee, an annual service.
Right.
And their students would get access to this tool.
Oh my goodness. You must have had very little turnover.
Yes. Oh yeah. Yeah. The adoption was unbelievable. Like just huge number of schools that, because again, back in that time frame, the counselors sat there with annual printed calendars. And manually had to help students figure out whether or not they could get into McGill or U of T or whatever it was.
Right. Yeah.
And now we're saying, hey, you don't even have to do anything, counselor.
Right.
Your student just logs in, plugs in their courses and grades, and magically a list appears of, you know, programs that they could get into or,
right.
you know, and even if they couldn't, if the likelihood wasn't high, it would tell them why.
Mm.
Oh, your math 10
you know,
needs to have a higher grade point average.
if you're wanting to go to McGill. And then at that point, I'm guessing there were so many constraints in your program that directed students to a much smaller ecosystem of choices to make. All they'd have to make the choice of is, do I want to go West Coast, East Coast, size of school, are my friends going to that school or whatever, versus can I get in, which is right. The primary decision that they want to.
And the stress for that student or the student's parents and like, right. Oh, you know, we really want you to go to McGill and, you know, right. You still might apply.
Yeah.
Even if you know you're not a perfect match. But then, of course, you make the decision to apply to three more, right? Okay. Oh, I'm also maybe going to go and apply to Dalhousie or UBC. Right. And
for sure. Yeah, so it's almost like people putting the cart before the horse. You're putting the cart exactly where it should be.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, let's be realistic.
First things first.
And let's make sure you got all your options.
Right.
And you're not maybe missing a year because you didn't get accepted.
That's nice. So you sort of set their expectations. I'd like to drill a little bit deeper into that and ask, how did your team, disseminate that? So who did you first start with? Which schools did you start with? How did you do that? How did you choose them? How did that wildfire start?
Great question. Cause a lot of my background has been around sales and marketing. And in launching Student Counselor and getting that adoption, it was very much a sales and marketing hand-in-hand exercise. And so we actually started by going nationwide right out of the gate, which, you know, that's a choice where, let's build up a local client base and then start to roll it out.
Mm-hmm.
We decided that, we were going to... we acquired a database of high schools and private schools in particular, because of course they were more motivated and interested. And we started with a direct mail campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had an inside sales team that called. And I actually went on the road for 4 months doing presentations to high school guidance counselors right across the country.
Wow.
So, a combination of some technology sort of sales and marketing, but then still at the end of the day, because of the audience being guidance counselors, email marketing wasn't going to work on its own.
Right.
And it was a new product and a new service. It needed to be demoed so that they truly understood, what it could do, how powerful it was. And then the third part of the strategy was we offered free trials in the beginning. Mm-hmm. So we basically said, here, you can, we were so confident that this was just sort of the next best thing since sliced bread for guidance counselors. Mm-hmm. We basically said, and it was.
Yeah.
You can have the first 3 months for free. And so you get it from September to December. And then again, when those free trials were coming off their free time frame, the inside sales team was following up with, trying to close the deal. And the close rate was like 90%.
Wow.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was a really fun ride. And, being on the road for that long wasn't my first choice, but we very quickly figured out, direct mail and email wasn't going to cut it for something this new and with the audience of guidance counselors. That wouldn't be true today, of course, but, again, we're talking early internet days.
Yeah, and this is a revolutionary product. They have no frame of reference.
No, right. Exactly. They couldn't compare it to anything. There was nothing out there to compare it to.
So how did you make that leap? Did you have something you compared it to that was old and then saying, and then here's our thing, which is the twist? Or
it was really a demo.
Uh-huh.
It was really just showing them.
This is the
We basically had a mock student.
Uh-huh.
And we showed, here's a grade 11 student, and here's the courses they've taken, and here's the grades. And when we click this button, here's the dynamic results that come back. And, you know, and of course the counselors all wanted to pull out their calendars and check the data to make sure that, oh, okay, well, you know, I see it's not matching on UBC Business School for this student.
Yeah.
Why? Mm-hmm. And you could drill down and see why. You know, it was a certain course they were missing or a certain grade point average. And the counselors would pull out their calendars, their books,
mm-hmm.
old school, and go, mm-hmm. oh, yeah, okay, that's right. And and that actually, I mean,
wow.
that was probably the biggest part of gaining their trust, is that they had to trust that the data that we were basing this on was up to date and accurate.
Accurate.
Right. Because we're talking about people's futures.
People's lives.
It's wow. a big decision.
That's fascinating.
And the school, if they're going to subscribe to this, right. by default, is endorsing it.
And it's their job.
Yeah.
That yeah, they're like a doctor-patient relationship almost.
Yeah.
Right? You're steering something critical and vital.
Yes.
To their future.
Yeah.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
That must have been such a rewarding time.
It was. It was very rewarding.
Wow. And where did you go from there?
So from there, I was part of founding an e-commerce business mm-hmm. called PortoLynx. It doesn't exist today as it was founded. And so I'm probably a little off on my dates here in terms of where things are, but you know, this is around 2006, 2007, that sort of time frame. You know, e-commerce and e-commerce marketplaces were, you know, really taking off.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a business that was essentially providing a e-commerce platform that the small business didn't have to know how to do anything. So we were going after small businesses that were bricks and mortar
mm-hmm.
and didn't have a website, or if they had a website, it's what, you know, you call that brochure website that Yellow
right.
Pages gave them for free with right. their annual listing and didn't do anything for them, right?
It looked free.
It looked free, exactly. It had a phone number and,
yeah.
you know, that was about as useful as it was.
What else do we need?
Yeah.
The number's there.
Yeah, the number's there.
Call
They're
us.
Gonna call.
Yeah, there's my address even.
Yeah, they can come by. but, you know, for the early adopters in small businesses that realize that, you know, they could double their business by offering an e-commerce website and still be able to pack and ship the product, you know, providing them with a turnkey e-commerce platform that allowed them to do that. And all they had to do was sign up for an account with us.
Mm-hmm.
And we migrated everything for them. We set it all up for them. We had all of the gateways and payments and everything all figured out for them. And they literally just had to receive the orders in their email inbox and, you know, pick and pack and ship like they normally do.
Right. That must have been kind of revolutionary again. But
yes,
to those customers.
It was new. That's right.
Because that's usually what technology, it doesn't matter how advanced it is, but it's who you're providing that solution to. That's right.
Yes.
And that
correct.
Is revolutionary.
Yes.
In that case, partner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was new for them. And there were, you know, they were definitely, again, companies that, oh, I'm not sure this e-commerce thing is really, you know, for us. and then, you know, you had the people that knew that they were leaving money on the table. This was something that was going to help their business. And our secret sauce was that they didn't have to pay us any money. We just took a commission on all the transactions. Right. And again, if you rewind back to that era,
mm-hmm.
Getting an e-commerce website set up, a lot of digital marketing agencies were charging thousands of dollars
right.
to do this.
Right. Still, they're charging thousands of dollars. I'm surprised when some people.
Yeah. But at least nowadays you can go to, you know, a Weebly or a Shopify and,
sure.
you know, more or less set up your site.
Mm-hmm.
Relatively easily and cheaply.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't really exist at that point in time.
Yeah, a Squarespace is pretty amazing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
So we were, you know, I would say an earlier business of those types of
mm-hmm.
models, very performance-based again, so there was no risk to the business.
Mm-hmm.
Um, they just had to be comfortable paying us a fee of, say, 10%. You know, our costs might be the equivalent of 3%, so we were making a margin on every transaction.
That's fantastic.
And, yeah, but, you know, as with a lot of payments businesses, the business model very much requires scale. You know, so you have all these fixed costs and these fixed overheads, and you really only start to, you know, be successful when you reach a certain volume and a scale.
For sure.
And that didn't happen with that business.
So
we ran out of money before we were able to get to profitability. And so, you know, that business had a 3-year run. Again, learned tons in terms of the technology and the market and sales and marketing, but it wasn't able to get to that scale quick enough.
For sure. How close did you get to that level? Did you get 2/3 of the way to the goal, or was it much further or much closer?
It was close. Yeah, it was. That was part of the sad, painful, and frustrating part, is it was really quite close. And so in the last year of the business, you know, almost everybody was laid off so that we can conserve cash. And myself and the founder went down to Silicon Valley and did the fundraising roadshow stuff. Which again was another great learning exercise in terms of pitching VCs and what VCs want to hear and how they conduct themselves. And you know, the lesson for me out of that exercise was our timing for our business model wasn't aligned with the popular business model with the VC community at the time. So e-commerce was on a little bit of a slow side. Social networks were all taking off in that era, the Facebooks of the world. And VCs, I just remember sitting in several meetings and they all kept saying, so can you turn this into a social network? No, but maybe I should have said yes. Maybe that's really the learning I should have taken out of that.
To do whatever they want.
Yeah. But, you know, the honest person in me couldn't spin it quite that much.
Right, right. You don't strike me as much of a yes gal as well.
No. I like to be pretty confident and, you know, I'm ambitious, I'm optimistic, but I also need to see that, you know, that path of, you know, this is how we're going to get there. And I might have unrealistic targets and goals, but, you know, I can see how we're going to get there. And it just might take longer to get there than what I'd hoped. But yeah, so the timing is everything in business. And I actually think it was Gladwell. You were mentioning him earlier. I think it was actually one of his earlier books that was talking, had done a whole bunch of analysis around new startups and what was the most important factor for a startup to succeed.
Yes.
And his conclusion was timing. I completely agree with that. You know, obviously you still have to have other things working well, but if you hit the market at the right time, gaining traction in terms of customer adoption or being able to access funding from VCs, that is going to help you be successful and reach that scale or that critical mass or that profitability, whatever it is that you're trying to achieve, more likely. We didn't hit the window dead on Portal Links, but it was, you know, a very successful business to the point that it got to.
Shall we fast forward a little bit here? 2015 and 16 was a couple of big years for you. You've joined Viatech, awarded Executive of the Year, and the Stevie Awards gave you you were a silver level winner. Will you tell us a little bit about those?
I mean, that's where I sort of consider myself lucky. You know, Viatech has been an amazing community, an amazing organization. Dan himself has been extremely supportive and very forward thinking in terms of women in tech in particular. And, you know, I definitely credit him for a lot of the dynamics in our tech community here. You know, in a lot of ways, ViaTech is far more diverse, far more proactive, and, you know, for women in particular, far more supportive and encouraging for having female tech entrepreneurs, females on the ViaTech board, recognizing females at the awards, mm-hmm. You know, supporting groups like Ladies Learning Code, all of those things. I have felt very welcomed in that organization, and feel that, you know, getting some of that recognition is all started with Dan recognizing me for that Executive of the Year award. And because the Stevies came after that, Dan was first and the ViaTech award was first.
I'm sure he'd be proud of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why did he choose you for Executive of the Year?
I don't know. I think Dan would probably have the true answer. I don't know what his true reason was.
All right, we're gonna have to catch up with him then.
Yeah, yeah. But it's, you know, especially if you rewind a few years ago, there was very few women CEOs in Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
And there was very few.
Early time of RevenueWire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's, well, I joined RevenueWire in 2009. So it had already started to reshape RevenueWire into a global payments company.
Sure.
And,
but at this point is when you were chosen Executive of the Year, you had already gone through that 400% growth.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And so, you know, there was some track record there and there's history and some success, and there wasn't a lot of female CEOs. So, you know, I think that, I don't know, I think it was a good decision.
Yeah.
I'm biased.
Yeah, I'm sure you're not the only one who thinks that. And so I'm new to Victoria. I was here in the early 90s, and then I've been in the US for 20 years now. And I'm just returning. So tell me a little bit about Victoria and women in Victoria and CEOs since that time.
You know, I've been in Victoria Tech for 20 years. And half of that, I've been much more actively involved in the tech community and ViaTech and other local events. And, you know, it's almost night and day. So even if I go back to sort of the late 90s, I had moved here from Ottawa. Well, Ottawa was called Silicon Valley North. In Canada, they had a huge tech community. And so when I moved out here and actually went through this realization of how small it is, I had a few months of almost panic of, oh my God, I've made the wrong decision. I've come back home too soon. You know, the tech community, how much it's grown and progressed and evolved and become much more mature and sophisticated in the past 20 years is huge. It's night and day. I mean, the number of tech companies has grown immensely. The diversity of the tech community, you know, used to be very sort of engineering, small under 10. You know, now we have some killer whales. Now we have, you know, a variety of sectors from payments to gaming to performance marketing that are very strong sectors. In some cases, Victoria's, you know, the world leader in those industries. So, and then even in more recent years, I would say that, you know, my lens being more from that female perspective, going from a single female on the ViaTech board to now there's four of us.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that's awesome. And other female tech founders in town, which, you know, have either participated in the ViaTech programs, the incubator and accelerator programs, or have on their own initiative started tech companies. You know, that just didn't exist 20 years ago.
And what about multiculturally? What have you seen there?
Again, I think Victoria is a much more diverse city than it's ever been. And I go back to, you know, my childhood days where, you know, Victoria, of course, was known as newlywed and nearly dead.
Right.
And was extremely white. And, you know, I was so excited to actually leave Victoria back then.
So
you
was
know,
I.
And you go to...
Couldn't wait to leave.
Yeah, I couldn't wait to leave either. I was like, oh, yeah. Sign me up, Ontario. I'm out. I'm off this rock.
I went to New York.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Well, you can't get any better than New York. I mean, that's amazing. Even though I lived in Ottawa, we had a lot of clients in Toronto. So, Toronto is like a version of New York. It's just the diversity and the different neighborhoods and communities.
Right.
So Victoria today is 1,000% better. I mean, it's far more diverse ethnically, as well as, you know, age generations and... Right. Even the, of course, the economy, everything about Victoria is a much healthier, better balanced, better place to live than it's ever been.
How would you describe the people that find Victoria home?
That's an interesting question. So it's interesting because I think there's actually two divisions of people in Victoria that call Victoria home. There is the born and bred, Victoria people, and I'm in that group because this is where I grew up. I had the benefit of moving away and seeing other things in life. And then you've got, of course, as you know, all the people who are transplants. They might have been living in Victoria now for years, but they're originally from, let's call it back east, or even the States, moving up from the States. And so,
Or escaping Vancouver.
Calgary. Exactly. I mean, Vancouver, in some ways, sometimes it's like that competition thing.
Yeah. Big brother, little brother.
Yeah. It's just
big sister, little sister.
Yeah. You know the island.
It's just Victoria.
It's just Victoria.
It's sleepy over there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Keep thinking that.
Yeah, yeah.
I have had this little siblings growing up.
Yeah. I've had, this past year, we did a fair bit of fundraising type of conversations for future pay. And I've had conversations with Toronto VCs, Vancouver, San Fran, New York, all over the place. And the Vancouver people, well, the Toronto people don't even want to talk to you.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you're out there? No. Yeah. This is the center of the universe. Unless you're here, I'm not even going to entertain this conversation.
Beyond the castle wall.
Yeah, exactly. There's this mode and bye-bye, you're on the other side. And then Vancouver is like, wow, that company's in Victoria? So they'll talk to you because you're neighbors.
Right.
You know, it's still very much this wow factor for them.
Right.
And then San Fran is like, they just, oh, yeah, yeah, I we invested in a company up there. We were up there last fall. We, for you know, we went to the Viatech event. We went... I'll talk to you.
Yeah, there's some VC cross-pollination happening as well, from what I understand. I don't know a lot about it. I understand there's a VC event. Someone up here pulls them up here. And then also in Kelowna, I want to say.
Yeah, you're right, Kelowna.
VC event. Yeah, correct. So I'm just learning about that.
Yeah.
Do you know about those?
Yes. So I'm not sure if they're called a group, but they are initiated by Viatech and DAM.
Oh.
And he usually teams up with Owen Matthews, who's, you know, a huge, successful local entrepreneur, or with Razul, or Colin Howe, a couple other individuals as well, like even Craig Thompson. But there's a small group of, you know, guys that have had success, had successful exits, have a good Rolodex of VCs, and that are very actively involved with Viatech. And so Dan and this group have been on a mission for the past 3 or 4 years of getting more and more of these early stage investor type people to come and visit. And so they usually pair it up with our annual Viatech events that take place in January or September. And they'll bring in a group of VCs and essentially host them and introduce them to some of the local companies and take them on tour. And, you know, they all get here and they all do the same thing. wow, we didn't realize you had this here.
Yeah, and we're a direct flight away.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Exactly.
Let me take a quick break and thank our returning sponsors, Roundtable Consulting. Roundtable Consulting serves organizations in providing facilitation and research, as well as business and strategic planning needs. Roundtable Consulting also helps with reconciliation, from building a more inclusive workspace to diversity training. Please learn more about Roundtable Consulting at roundtableconsulting.ca.
What are women great at in tech? Is there something different that you find they bring to the table?
There is. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've quite figured out what that answer is or what that aspect is.
I shouldn't say quite.
Yeah, it's
I hate to gender based.
But it is. But it is, right? I mean, men and women are different by and large. We just think different. Totally. We just think different. We communicate differently. We approach things differently. And you feel it when you go into, so a lot of times women who come to interview at RevenueWire, you know, they get interviewed by me, my VP of HR, Kim, my VP of business development, Sue. And they're all like, oh my God, I'm coming into a company with female leaders and, you know, roughly half of the team is female and they come from a company that is literally 90% or more male.
For sure.
Right. Wow. Developers, sales guys, whatever.
Leaders.
And leaders. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that culture is male skewed.
Right.
Testosterone.
No, it is.
You know, it just is, right?
For sure.
The conversation, you know, whether it's sports or golf or whatever it is.
Right.
Not that women don't play sports or talk sports.
For sure. Yeah.
But we tend to like about shopping better than sports. I'm into that.
That's right. If shopping was important, they would make it a world sport.
That's
like
right.
A World Cup. Yeah.
Well, there could be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There should be.
There's women who are really good at that.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. There has to be scoring in different ways.
But it's a different culture. And the answer would be communication.
Yeah.
And it's not that it's a communicate or not. It's a style. It's, you know. And collaboration, I think, is that, you know, and here I'm stereotyping because I think for the most part, most women want to collaborate and compromise.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of men want to win.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And so you got competitive women and they want to win.
Right.
But by and large, they want the whole team to win.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not worried about being the top dog and just winning for the sake of winning.
Right.
You almost can... you know, look to somebody like Trump and go, well, there's there's a sample of what, you know, male leadership is.
Right.
Not
yeah.
Thank God all male leaders aren't like him.
Right.
But and I apologize if you voted for him.
But I have stumbled across him a couple of times. We shared the same revolving door.
There we go.
At
Trump Tower.
Yeah, no, actually, I worked in the same building as Howard Stern. And so when I would come to work, guests would often leave.
And he was often a guest.
Yeah, that's right. And also it was just a half walk away.
Yeah.
So he was a frequent guest, you know.
Yeah, he totally was.
God, I wouldn't be surprised if he made those remarks about his daughter one of those days that I saw him. That's an epiphany. But I like to go back what you were saying, which is really interesting, which is, women don't care, especially about perhaps, if I can highlight, their individual career versus the team moving forward.
Yeah. And there's always exceptions, accurate? Right? There's exceptions on the male side. There's exceptions on the female side. But I think nowadays, women are much supportive in helping other women. And I think for me, having spanned 30 years of career, I would say in my early part of my career, because there was fewer women and you had to fight for those senior roles, it was more competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the fact that those days seem to be behind us. Mm-hmm. And I think women, newer generations, as well as just, you know, a newer climate nowadays, women are much more about helping other women and collectively, you know, we're going to make it easier for women to have leadership roles and approaching it that way. And I think, you know, again, I don't know if it's a generational thing or if it's, you know, the way in which we're going to help change things is by having strength in numbers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you need to have more women sitting around the boardroom. I mean, I can't tell you how many boardrooms and tables that I've been at where, you know, most times it's I'm the only woman, female.
Right.
That is changing. Mm-hmm. You know, there is more women sitting at the table. And so I don't know if that's more of the teamwork, the collaboration, the working together. Mm-hmm. And then I also have to say, boy, who helped me in my career are men. Mm-hmm. I did have one female mentor early on in my career, but most of my mentors or people who have opened a door for me or have said to me those words that made me feel confident have been men. And that's great. To me, that's the, you know, we're all working together as a team, as a group, as a tribe to make things better. And you can't make things better, I don't believe, at least. You can't make things better for winning. I'm the only winner. I have to win. I have to get the best deal.
I like something I read, I think, from a Buddhist monk who was saying, how can you be better than anyone? You can't be taller than that tall person. You can't be better at getting low things than that short person or whatever.
We're equal.
You can't be better.
Yeah.
You're all just individually different.
Yeah.
You can't be better.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
It's you impossible. Are you. Impossible. Yes. Yeah. But there, and that's a great philosophy. Mm-hmm. But then if you look at things like sports.
Yeah, for sure.
You always end up with a winner.
Yeah.
Right? And that's.
Second is the first loser.
Yes. My grandpa actually said that to me once.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
You're not first, you're last.
Yeah, yeah. Second is the first loser. He would say that. And and again, I think generations that has evolved. But again, if you go back to my generation, I mean, the program I was in at Laurentian University for sport marketing, business degree, had 4 women.
Wow. Out of 30?
Out of a 30, yeah. Out of a class of around 30. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean,
12%
and or so. Historically speaking, you know, there are more men who participate in sport than women.
Yeah.
It's getting better and better every single year and generation. And that was another interesting thing I've read more than once. When they go and look at female CEOs, 99% of them played competitive sports.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. Mm. So it's that competitiveness, that desire to win, that, but usually you're in a team or you're part of a group, a coach, you know, you can never win something on your own.
Right.
It's near impossible.
And as a father of daughters, I'm just getting a flashback to something else going through social media maybe last year or the year before of them asking, you know, what's it like to run like a girl? Did you see that?
No, yeah, I didn't.
And it's all kids, right? You know, they have different age groups and stuff, right? And, you know, I think it was something like below 10, it was like, you know, just some girl like, oh, this is how I run. You know, she looks, you know, like she's running. And then in the teens, it looks kind of like they're all, you know, wispy or whatever you want to say. And so there is a, you know, a socialization or what have you, you know, at a particular age. And I love pointing out to my young daughters, I'm like, oh, look, there's a girl mechanic. There's a boy doctor, you know, it doesn't matter.
But that age, that age of 11, 12, 13, there's tons of research out there, how girls change at that age. And the most important influence at that age is the father. Not the mother. The father. How actively involved the father is in that girl's life at that time in their development. And again, this is all hindsight, but I remember every day after school waiting for my dad to come home, and he would play football with me in the backyard every day. Right. So it was at some point in certain years, it was baseball because I always played baseball. But then it was football, and you'd give me the plays and I'd run them out and he'd throw them. And but he always was actively involved, even though my mom was a huge sports fan and still is.
Yeah.
He was the one who was actively involved with me in helping me perfect my sports skills. And that is a critical point. So. Right. There you go with your girls.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
if that's important in, you know, your upbringing and with
girls. Well, no, it's not important. Rugby is more important.
Do your girls play rugby?
They will.
Oh, that's awesome. I love it.
And then they're going to be astronauts.
Love it.
Which may not be a big thing, actually, by the time. You know, it's more like.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That would just be like, oh, they're just an astronaut.
Yeah. It's like female doctors. I mean, it's almost 50% now.
That's right.
Yeah.
But also it'll be just like a regular trade. It won't be.
Yeah.
You know.
That was actually the other.
I'm a long-haul Mars astronaut driver.
Yeah. That was the other name I suggested for the award. Is I suggested Bondi.
For the Viatek Award.
For the Viatek Award after Roberta Bondar.
Oh.
As the first Canadian.
Why do I know that name?
Roberta Bondar.
Oh, of course. We have a book, actually. We have a kid's book.
Oh.
On her life.
Neat.
Yeah. It's one of these almost, I guess, sort of aimed at, say, 8-year-olds or 7-year-olds. Like, this is a rocket launching and this is.
Cool.
Yeah. Like, oh, I know why. I know that because I've read it 20 or 30 times to my girls. You know,
that's neat.
I want to get back a little bit to what you were saying about women in the workplace. And I'd like to talk about two things. And please help me remember these. I serve on the board with a woman who we had an interesting conversation together, who she was talking about the complement of the current board of men and women, also ages. And but in particular to gender, as she had brought up, because it's my first year and she had been on for a few other years. So she had seen, you know, different
change.
Change, gender, ages, you know, experiences and stuff like this. And she said, our current board was good in the way, in the current complement because it was a good division of women and men. In the past, you know, so like a half and half or something. But in the past, she had served on one that was mostly women. And she said it was like, whoa, it's like way too much, for instance, conversation and talking and less,
doing,
yeah. and then, of course, it could be the exact opposite, obviously.
Yeah.
And I hate making, you know, gender, you know, broad strokes and all this. But I would like to hear maybe in your perspective and experience what that has been like. And it's because you piqued my interest when you said Revenue Wire is 50-50. And I'm wondering if you find that's it's a nice, like, sweet spot or something like this.
You know,
not like I'm sure Amy would be like, oh, better get another guy on the team. Better get another girl on the team.
No. And, you know.
What's your experience been?
I like the balance. I mean, I personally wouldn't, for the type of businesses that I've been involved with, I wouldn't want an all-female team. You know, I think the whole point of diversity is that you have different perspectives. I mean, not only do we have a lot of male-female in leadership as well as on specific teams, we have a lot of ethnic variety as well. So not only just in terms of visible minorities, but also people who have moved here from other countries. So they bring, you know, new perspectives, different views on things.
Yeah, they could be Caucasian from a whole host of different cultures.
Yeah, that's right. They can be from Germany. They can be from Britain.
Australia.
They can, Australia, absolutely. Or China and India and
Canada.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. They can still be from here.
Calgary.
Yeah. 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 Those newfies, boy.
we got one here.
Yeah. I we don't have one. I'd like one.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
They're fun.
Well, we can ship them in. There's a direct flight, you know. Let me know if you need it.
But it's all of that. So I wouldn't
I
think too much of one type is gonna get a group think mentality.
For sure.
And you miss things then, right? Because you're not thinking differently. You're not bringing in a new perspective.
You can't think differently.
No.
The group in whole has no experience in that.
And even so, the
culture,
other thing.
Maybe economic, demographic, you know, such as like
all, life experiences.
Yeah, say
everything.
It's all private school people. I mean, obviously, I'm drawing broad strokes here. Or maybe it's only public school people and they don't have a perspective on private schools. And
educated, even university educated versus not. Different 100%. Ways of thinking on things.
Totally. I'm sure even East Coast, West Coast.
Yeah.
All West Coast people probably couldn't appreciate all East Coast things or something if they're getting into that market or what have you.
The other part that we've done for a few years now at Revenue Wire is we go and we do this assessment and then this group training on communication style.
Mm.
And it's four quadrants. So you've got expressives.
Mm-hmm.
So you're an expressive. Shocking, I know. Driver, I'm a driver.
Uh-huh.
Analytical
mm-hmm.
and amiable. And each style, of course, communicates differently.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the point of learning the different styles is so that you can flex
mm-hmm.
to the other person's style. The onus mm-hmm. is on me to, you know, recognize your style and flex mm-hmm. to your style.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But if we had too many expressives in the office, I would go nuts.
Right.
Because expressives like to talk. And I just like to get shit done.
That's right. Would you please stop expressing yourself?
Okay, we've had 10 minutes of expressiveness. Can we move on now?
That's right. Let's talk about moving on.
Yeah.
I'd love to. I saw something interesting on moving on the other day. Me too. I did. Get me out of here.
And then the analytical.
In the coffee shop.
And the analytics are just sitting there going, oh my God, will all these people just shut up? I have to think about what we're talking about. And the amiables, of course, are just like, yeah, yeah, whatever you want. Yeah, yeah.
You're all right.
Yeah, you're all, whatever you want. Yeah. Uh-huh. I will eat shit, even if you tell me to eat shit.
Right,
I don't
want
to eat shit, but I will because I want to make you happy.
Right, right, right. You know, I'm struck by an interesting idea. Like, if only there was maybe a service or something where, you know, people could go and they could take testing that would put them into, for instance, like these particular, you know, groupings. I recently revisited my Myers-Briggs, which I found was identical. That's always nice. But then also re-educated myself and reoriented myself on that. And, like if you could do this testing, employees could do a particular testing, and then you could see what's the complement of your company.
Yeah.
Oh, we score really high in people who have West Coast attitude, East Coast attitude, high economic demographic, low, different cultures, men, women. Like I wonder if
it's very helpful.
You could have a full graph and then you would see, for instance, for those of us who are just listening to us, I'm making big gestures with my hands. like maybe there's areas, of course, that are missing. And then you can make an educated hiring decision.
Well,
perhaps like, well, we could go for someone who knows more about XYZ. You know, we could really go for someone who has this cultural aspect that would add to broaden our perspective.
And it should, right? It should influence your hiring.
Mm-hmm.
It should influence how you even set up your internal mentoring, right? To couple people so that they're compatible. So when we started doing this communication style training, the company was heavily skewed, expressive and analytical. We had a couple drivers and a couple amiables, but heavily skewed. And it has, over time, influenced how we interview people and what we look for. And so now we're actually way more balanced than we used to be. I'd still say we're you know, the smallest group is still amiable, but we have way more balance on analytical, expressive, and driver than we did, you know, when we first started doing this exercise. And then it's one of those things too where you need a couple of training, right? Because it's one thing to, it's fun, you take the test and then you have a one-day workshop and you learn about things. And but I've been in conversations with people where they'll come to me and say, I am so frustrated in dealing with this person.
Right.
I'm like, oh, what communication style are they? Well, I don't know. Well, I know you're expressive and they're analytical. And you can just see their face drop, right? It's like, I get it. Okay. So, you know, maybe pull out your, we have a little cheat sheet, pull it out again. And, and it tells you, it gives you little tips for how to communicate with drivers versus expressive versus analytical. And it's, and it's very practical and it works.
Would you share that with us? I'll put a link maybe or something.
Yeah, absolutely. But it should infuse your whole company, right? If you're doing these personality assessments and, you know, the purpose is to help your team communicate better or help leaders coach their, you know, their team members better. All of that needs, you know, to be part of the fabric of the company. And and you need to refresh yourselves as well from the training perspective, because you get into bad habits and you forget some of the principles.
I want to get back to the second thought that I had, which is this philosophy, and this is going way back in our conversation here when you're talking about a greater amount of women coming up through the ranks and reaching down and helping them, the other ones up and whatnot. But I had read an interesting perspective of this queen bee. Are you familiar with this? This queen bee, I don't know what they call it, attitude or perspective or queen bee syndrome or something like this, where it would be thought, I think this is what it was saying in the article, it was there's speculation that as women move into filling the industry here, other ones falling behind would then be helped up because they're naturally, you know, the same tribe pulling the other ones up. But in fact, it's the opposite, where there's actually a queen bee, I don't know, syndrome or something like this, in which there's a repression of sorts. And boy, am I reaching back in my memory. I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago. So please, you know, I've got great, you know, latitude with remembering, but it was something in broad strokes like that. And I'm pretty sure it was like from Harvard Business Review, where it was like a fascinating article where they really had a lot of, you know, interesting insights based on some testing and blah, blah, blah. But that really affected me because I also was thinking like that was a natural inclination of, say, any culture or gender. Whoever's getting into, whoever's getting a break would then reach back to whomever culture or gender they came from to help them along. Have you experienced that, or have you talked with other women who have experienced this? I hate to say, I think it's queen bee syndrome or something like that.
Yeah, and I'm not familiar with that. Okay. I personally haven't experienced it, and I certainly have the view of, you know, you've got to help more women. You know, you've got to be a mentor. You got to be a good role model. You know, if you're the first one on that board, you better come prepared and you know, be a good board member. And so that, you know, the women coming along next, you know, everybody else around that table had a positive experience and, you know, bringing more female board members or for more females onto the board is a good thing. But no, the I don't deny that it probably exists and there probably is that syndrome happening. I fortunately haven't had to deal with that. And, you know, maybe it's the type of thing because most of my career has been with, you know, companies that are more or less under 100. I think if you went into a much larger organization, you're going to get much different dynamics.
Different industries.
Different industries too. Yeah. Yes,
absolutely. Their example actually was like Hillary Clinton. And so politics in and of itself, I would say, is a very cutthroat industry.
Yeah, totally.
Obviously. But then when it comes to technology and similar industries, I think that could be grouped with technology that's very innovative and forward-thinking, like, say, fashion, music, stuff like this. I think it has a much different culture than, say, a more antiquated, if you could say that, about politics and maybe some other industries that could be grouped together. And perhaps, I wonder if Queen Bee is more predominant in that, say, grouping of industries versus our grouping of industries or something.
Yeah,
like
tech is so collaborative. It's such a, and I agree with you on the fashion and some of those other industries. You know, even if you think of the, you know, a lot of tech companies have open offices.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
Because you're encouraging the creative thought process and the collaboration. Yeah. And so that culture, that community more broadly, I think encourages that. Whereas, I think if you go into a very competitive area where it's much more hierarchical and, you know, everybody's vying for that corner office or that seat on, you know, as a senator, like Hillary Clinton, then the dynamics are very different in those careers, those professions.
That's interesting because I'm thinking of what you said earlier, which is the women that you've worked with and whatnot. You said a lot of them, in your experience, wanted to move the entire team forward versus their own personal agenda or career. Perhaps that's the commonality between all of the grouping of music and fashion that we are talking about versus this other grouping that's political and maybe you could say financial world as well. That's a very individually oriented career path. And perhaps that is more predominant with this particular
Queen Bee thing.
Wow. We could be weaving gold here.
Interesting. I'm going to Google that now, you know, when I go home tonight because I'm curious.
No doubt. I would like to hear a little bit more. Do you have a little more time?
Yeah, okay. I do.
I have a few more questions in regards to maybe your advice to women who are coming up through the ranks. Say it's their first year in startups or even just, you know, technology in general. Or say it's their fifth year, say a little bit more senior, intermediate, maybe a team lead. Could you give a little bit more advice to women in those roles?
Yeah, and I think, you know, broad sweeping in terms of advice is just to be confident in who you are. Be confident in what you're bringing to the table, the skills, the knowledge, the hardworking ethic, whatever it is that you deserve to be there as much as anybody else.
Sure.
And, you know, I think in a lot of cases, you're probably underestimating your value. And that's what I'm trying to imply with the confidence and own it and feel confident in who you are and what you're bringing to the table. And I think that sometimes women aren't as demanding, you know, when it comes to, say, promotions, asking for raises. Again, I think that's something that's gotten better over the generations, but I still, you know, as a CEO, I have to say I get asked by men way more for a raise than the female workers. Mm. I've probably set up a whole bunch of poor CEOs now for women are going to go marching to their doors asking for raises. But,
and
you know.
Also, you have not been helping the, you know, by adding, you know, increasing men's revenues. You're certainly not helping.
Oh, I didn't say so I approve them. I just say they ask for it more. No, I'm all about, you know, fairness, and, you know, you're paying for the role, and it's nothing to do with men or women. But, you know, I have to say that it's usually the men that are asking for that promotion or that raise or that increase. It's actually quite rare that the women come in and ask for that. And, you know, so it's confidence, it's know your value. You only look after yourself. So you have to speak up and ask for what you want. You might not get approved, but it's a good practice and a good experience to ask.
You miss 100% of the pitches you don't swing at.
Yeah, exactly. If you don't swing for the fence, you're never going to get a home run.
What are some phrases men use when they ask for a raise?
Oh, boy. I don't...
What do people say? What do men say?
Yeah, men tend to, and I'm generalizing here, but they tend to talk about the value that they've brought to the company or the role, what they've done, what they've achieved. And unfortunately, women tend to talk a little bit more about why they need a raise. And it's, you know, that's not why you would give a raise.
Right.
You give a raise because, you know, they're bringing value to the organization. They've grown. They've taken on more responsibility. They're ready for a promotion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you need to come in with those business metrics mm-hmm. of what you've achieved and why you deserve this.
Because I did A, the result was B.
Yeah.
And a growth.
Or over the past year, I've taken on more of this, or, you know, you asked me to do this special project and I delivered it, mm-hmm. you know, across the company.
Take an initiative because I saw there was a piece missing.
Yeah.
Puzzle.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. What are the phrases that men use when they ask for a raise? So, Bobby.
Yeah. I'm
Ms. Leach.
I'm drawing a blank here because I can't think of anything.
Do you have a minute?
Recent.
Do you have a minute?
Well, we always have reviews, right? Okay. So we always have annual uh-huh. reviews.
Uh-huh. Oh, so it would be at that time.
It would be at that time. It would be an organized. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we always discuss salary. I don't make the people have to ask. Mm-hmm. It might be a conversation that says there isn't a salary increase this year, but I always, as a practice, we cover that topic in your annual review. Mm. And so definitely I've given raises where the individual has not agreed and has come back with their proposal. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that my experience is men will argue for more. Women rarely do. And just my experience, so,
for
you know,
sure.
Sample size of 100, men will, you know, very rarely accept what you just give them. Mm-hmm. They want to present their case for more.
Mm. And is that conversation in that review meeting, or is there like a follow-up meeting?
There's a follow-up meeting, yeah. Uh-huh.
That they request?
Yeah, or that they will present it. They come in prepared. They come in and present their case. And I might say, well, let me think about it. Mm-hmm. And so then there's a follow-up meeting to discuss mm-hmm. the outcome.
So there's no follow-up meeting set in the first place.
No.
So that's another key differentiator.
Yeah.
Which is saying, I think we should review it again.
Yes. And sometimes it's one of those things where we agreed to review it in 6 months. So instead of waiting a whole year, because maybe somebody's in the progress of evolving into a new level, but they're not quite there yet, but a year probably is too long. So we'll agree to meet again in 6 months.
And those reviews that you talked about, were those annual reviews?
Yeah.
They're annual reviews. Yeah. Okay. And you don't do them twice a year?
No. We don't. Okay. No.
And do you find that's enough, just out of curiosity?
Well, so that's your formal, broadly speaking. Yeah, that's your formal review. Your manager should be checking in with you on a regular basis. So whether it's, you know, weekly touch points or, you know, going for lunch quarterly just to sort of check in and make sure everything's fine. And and certainly people should be coming forward. If something's really changed drastically in 6 months, then that manager of that person should be coming forward and saying, look, you know, so-and-so left, they rose to the occasion, they've taken over all these duties, they really should be recognized for, you know, what they're doing, and and maybe a title change, a raise. Yeah, again, we have the annual reviews in place so that we don't miss having at least one formal event and discussion, but that absolutely should never preclude earlier conversations and discussions or recognizing people because they have taken, you know, they've really grown or they've taken on more responsibilities.
Would you say, how long would you say that follow-up meeting request is made? You have an annual review. And then how long is it? Have you found in your experience that men have come back and said, I'd like to have a follow-up meeting. Is it a week? Is it a month?
It's usually within the week. It's usually, you know, it might be 2 or 3 days of them letting it sit and percolate. but it's usually addressed within a week.
Okay. Yeah. And you have that follow-up meeting within a week.
Yeah.
You find you you want to do that.
Yes, I want to, I personally want to close the loop. You know, so if we discuss this and it's under consideration, then it's only respectful to deal with that in a timely manner. And I just, I might have to go back to my VP of HR and check, you know, some salary data or, you know, maybe check with somebody else regarding responsibilities that this person has taken on that I didn't realize, you know, that they had taken on.
That makes sense.
So, you know, there's things that I'd want to just check, discuss, but I would never want to leave somebody hanging for more than a few days. You know, those those conversations are really important and they're very sensitive. And, you know, the last thing you want to do is let somebody hang.
Yeah. That's the worst.
It is. It's a horrible feeling.
A fester.
Yeah, yeah, it totally does.
Yeah, I found that compensation is far deeper than, of course, just salaries. You know, what is money in the first place? But it's like value.
It's recognition.
Recognition.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Human value. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That you respect me, you recognize the value I bring to the company. You're rewarding me for all the extra effort I put in. It's way deeper than the numbers. And in fact, most times it's not the number, it's just the movement towards a number that is the most important part.
So especially sometimes, of course, a title change or more responsibility and whatnot as well.
Yeah, recognition.
For sure. Of growth.
Yeah.
Professional growth.
Yeah.
I found, broadly speaking, that, or I should say personally speaking, that I have blind spots into what I'm great at. And I think everyone does, right?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, right? I have those. Yeah.
You're like, what, everyone's not good at this? Like, no, you're great at this. We need you here because of X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again for coming in. Much appreciated. Any final thoughts?
No, no more final thoughts. I just... I'm just super happy to see how many more women are in tech and starting companies and, you know, breaking those glass barriers, as they call them. It's awesome.
If people want to get a hold of you, again, how do they get a hold of you?
I think I would just probably go to Revenue Wire, and they can reach me through the website. They email. Can easily, email rleach, L-E-A-C-H, at revenuewire.com. Mm-hmm. And they can easily find me through that. I think that's probably the easiest.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again for sharing your thoughts.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Thank you very much, Sean.
Thanks again to Bobby Leach for joining our program. Learn more about her at Revenue Wire. And thanks again to our returning sponsor, Roundtable Consulting. They serve organizations in providing facilitation and research, as well as business and strategic planning. Please learn more at roundtableconsulting.ca. Thank you again for Man Gender Bending, creating the intro, Quadratic Sound, providing audio support. And thanks again for joining me. See you again next week.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.